Welcome to Audio 7 of Discovery-Oriented Conversational Process inspired by Janella Bird. I am Josephine Stanton. The text of this audio is on the website https://talkthatheals.org. This audio describes the point of difference number 6, which describes the process of building a sense-making description or narrative to transform suffering into manageable pain. Pain is an inevitable and important part of life. The stories we build around painful events can intensify the distress we experience by generating feelings such as guilt, fear, shame and blame, abandonment, worthlessness and rage. It is common in any disaster associated with someone we love to add considerable suffering to the unavoidable grief and loss by making up stories about our having failed the person, not done enough. A collaborative discovery process engages the person in building a narrative or sense-making description in which they experience as intellectually and experientially coherent. Woven within this narrative is evidence confirming and producing a sense of personal agency. Incorporating the values and intentions they hold is personally affirming. Developing a narrative or a description like this can have the power to move the suffering generated by the stories our minds build into manageable pain. This can shift the experience of being disempowered and immobilized to provide a platform for movement. For this narrative to have the power to make this shift, it needs to be built out of the knowledge, values, experiences, and intentions the person holds. All our professional knowledge and experience cannot build such a narrative for someone else. The knowledge, experience, and skills we hold are important in helping us identify areas for exploration, but we cannot know what the person will bring forward. What they bring forward will often surprise them. A traditional psychological or biopsychosocial formulation developed collaboratively, that is, collaboratively in the sense of asking for ideas and checking with the person as to whether it is making sense to them, can also help with shifting suffering, but it is unlikely to have the same sort of power. If in any collaborative discovery process we find ourselves saying, "Does this make sense?" this is a red flag, and we need to consider whether we are developing the narrative and checking that we are taking the person with us, rather than using skills and engaging them in exploration to build the narrative out of what we find together. I have illustrated this with examples from my own life. This is not because my life is so fascinating everyone wants to read about it, but that I have permission to use my own information and the detail needed. The first example from my own life is around processing the loss of my younger sister. She died after a completely unexpected heart attack. Losing her was painful. There is no quick and easy way through a loss like this, but my mind made up a story of how I had let her down. If I had tried harder, I could have prevented her death. This was not completely outside the range of possibility. She had had an unusual illness in the week before the heart attack, which her doctors realized after her heart attack might have been unstable angina. If this was the case, and she had had an EEG during that illness, she could have had a stent and heart surgery before the heart attack happened. She would have had a good chance of survival, possibly for many years. She had had no specific pain, even when the heart attack happened. She had consulted her GP. I made several offers to go and see her, offer her help, but she turned these down. On the other hand, she did seem significantly unwell, with no sign of improvement for a week. I still wonder whether I could have, somehow, ascertained that this was a very odd illness and persuaded her to go to a comprehensive face-to-face assessment by clinicians in gowns, masks, and gloves to protect them from the possible infection. An ECG might have identified unstable angina, if indeed it was there. In the intensity of the story that I had let her down, I was suffering. I found myself unable to engage in life, work, and relationships. Neither could I accept or begin to process her loss. My focus was on fault in myself, on guilt, shame, and harsh self-judgment. I discussed possibilities with my GP, thought of how, post-COVID, we were much more circumspect about having contact with people who were ill and could be infectious. I talked with other people, and reflected on the values which had supported the decision I had made not to go against her wishes, see her in person, and interfere with her healthcare choices, even if I could have accessed the assessment. In retrospect, I regret that decision, but I have made sense of how I made it and the context around it. I am left with sadness, but have been able to let go of the suffering. I moved into feeling the loss, a loss I could share with my family and friends. The suffering I had been so alone with was transformed into manageable pain. A more multi-layered example occurred in the context of my having a five-minute slot to speak to the review committee overseeing the rewriting of the New Zealand Mental Health Act. This opportunity came up when I was away on a sailing holiday with my husband. On one level, it seemed pointless to interrupt this precious time for a five-minute slot, but the Mental Health Act has such power over so many people's lives, I wanted to take up the opportunity of any influence I might have, however small. Making a Zoom appointment on a sailing holiday is challenging. Internet access is variable. Choices we make about where we sail, when, and where we anchor are dictated by the direction and strength of the wind. This is hard to predict. I booked a slot at midday, hoping it would work out. The day of the appointment, we had internet access, but we also had the wind we needed to move to the next harbour, about 20 miles away. The wind tended to drop away later in the day, so it was frustrating to have to delay our departure to the afternoon. I zoomed in and waited my turn. I was a little flustered, but spoke clearly and felt I had made reasonable use of the limited time available. Despite this, after it was over, I was overwhelmed with distressing feelings I struggled to name. They were something like shame and incompetence. A family member whose judgment I respect had happened to watch and rang me, indicating support for how I had spoken. I appreciated the call, but there was only a brief attenuation of the distress I was feeling. I rang a friend and vented briefly, but she had limited time available and we were keen to set off. As we all know, wind and tide wait for no one. The sails were ready, we started the engine and pulled up the anchor. I struggled that afternoon. I was aware that I was being irritable, picky and fault-finding, but I didn't seem able to stop it. This added to my distress. I knew it was to do with the hearing, but I couldn't make sense of it. Of course it felt belittling to be given 5 minutes to speak to such an important issue when I had nearly 20 years' experience in thoughtful, careful use of the existing Mental Health Act. Our unit had led the way in stopping use of seclusion. I knew my friend would understand those things immediately. She had, but as with the phone call from my family member, it had made only a momentary dent in the distress I was feeling. My mind was building a story around, what's the matter with me? Through the afternoon and evening, I festered over it and struggled to manage my behaviour. I was able to enjoy the remote, unspoiled beauty of the sail and our next anchorage, but it was tempered. I apologised to my husband for the way I was behaving, but the well-oiled cooperation and shared joy, which were usually part of these holiday activities, were somewhat dampened. After considerable self-reflection and some collaborative discovery conversations with my friend, I was able to make sense of the experience I was having. This was a process rather than an aha moment, and I have done my best to describe it succinctly. I figured out that speaking to the review committee for the Mental Health Act was a triggering an experience I had had in an inquiry over a decade earlier. This inquiry was an important piece in the puzzle, but just making that connection wasn't enough to take the heat out of the effects of the "What's the matter with me?" narrative. The patient involved in the earlier inquiry had not died, but there was concern about the approach to care we had taken. This involved responsible risk-taking, minimising coercion and optimising the patient's autonomy. It was supported in the recovery movement and DBT approaches, but was well ahead of standard practice. We did not use seclusion and avoided use of restraint even in contexts such as her head banging or informing us of sharp objects inserted in body orifices. We had a locked area in the unit but minimised time young people spent there and supported escorted and unescorted leave even when there was risk of absconding. The choices we made for someone with intense unstable emotions and ongoing risk to self would not have been seen as so remarkable now. What is likely to make a difference to their risk in this context is a shift in their ability to manage emotions and distress, combined with hope of a life worth living. Physical containment and restraint can give an illusion of containing risk, but also have the potential to undermine recovery. The lead member of the inquiry team did not support the approach we took. The flavour of the inquiry reminded me of cross-examination of witnesses with the aim of discrediting them that I have seen in televised courtroom dramas. There were two specific points where I remained silent when I could have spoken in my own defence. In one, a specific choice I made was misrepresented in a misleading and negative way by one of the other witnesses. I could easily have given more context to explain the choice, but I didn't. There was another point where I had completed a legal form inadequately. I had explained my thinking in my clinical notes, which the inquiry team had access to, but the brief statement I had made on the legal form was inadequate. This was brought forward in a way which made me look incompetent. Again, I could have spoken to the context, but didn't. The advice we had been given by the legal team was to say as little as possible in case we made things more difficult for ourselves. I am also aware that in clinical work, engaging in an argument is seldom constructive. But neither of these things accounted for my failure to speak up where I was being misrepresented to my detriment. I had taken up a victim role of powerless passivity. This was fertile ground for my mind's narrative around what's the matter with me, which flooded me with feelings of shame and incompetence. I had thought I had shifted this experience in a recent inquest. In preparing for the inquest, I was determined I would not repeat the failure I remembered from the inquiry. I would speak what I knew. This was also fueled by the experience of sitting at my sister's bedside in ICU, knowing that she might die as she did. It was a great comfort to me that she was getting good quality care. I found it unbearable that the parents of the young person who had died should suffer not only the loss of their child, but also not be able to make sense of the care that she had been offered. I had prepared carefully for the inquest and felt satisfaction in the way I had been able to answer the family's concerns about their child's care. I could not make sense of why this had not superseded the previous experience of my taking up a victim role. It took some collaborative discovery conversations with my friend to make sense of my taking up the passive role in the earlier inquiry. Key to this was an episode of sexual abuse by a stranger I had experienced as a child. Though I did run away, initially I went along without challenging the abuser, despite uncomfortable feelings I could not name and process. I had lived most of my life feeling it was not particularly significant. In the process of writing the book, Finding Hope in the Lived Experience of Psychosis, I described this episode and found it was more significant than I had realized. Doing some structured exposure with self-soothing and distraction took some of the heat out of the effects of the experience. But in a conversation with Janella about this exposure as an example of a therapeutic process, she named the abuse of power I had experienced. This shook me. It was an aha moment. I had long been puzzled about a pattern I had noticed in myself of becoming disempowered and unable to respond effectively to some situations which could be described as an abuse of power by a man in the room. Once I had the conscious awareness of the connection with the childhood episode of abuse, I have never felt immobilized in this way again. However, the inquiry had happened before I had developed the conscious awareness of the abuse of power in that childhood experience. In the conversations with my friend, I made sense of the inability I experienced to speak in my defense in the inquiry as connected to the childhood sexual abuse. I made sense of the distress I experienced after my 5-minute Zoom with the Mental Health Act review panel as triggering a re-experiencing of the immobility I experienced at the inquiry. I did not become similarly immobilized in speaking to the Mental Health Act review panel or at the inquest, but speaking before the panel reactivated the older experience of being immobilized at the inquiry. I could not explain exactly why, but it didn't matter. I now had my cognitively and experientially congruent narrative based in my unique circumstances. I had made a sense of the tumult of feelings I was caught in after the Zoom. The power completely went out of the "what's the matter with me" story. My state of mind changed drastically. I was no longer irritable, picky, and unpleasant, hating myself and feeling flawed. I felt pain and sadness. I felt pain about the experience of the abuse, about the experience of the inquiry, about the loss of opportunities in the intervening decades and situations with controlling men. Most of these have been in clinical contexts, where there has been a man in a family taking up a power position. I have not been as helpful to the family as I could now, that I have made sense of the connection to my own abuse experience. I felt pain on behalf of all the people involved in abuse of power in our world, all the people who have been through sexual abuse and so much more. The experience which had affected me in these significant ways was minimal in comparison with what so many other people have been through. I also learned and reflected. I reflected on how I had dismissed the episode of sexual abuse from my childhood and what a difference some small interventions had made. I was able to talk with my husband about the pain and sadness I was feeling, which brought us back into connection with each other. I realised that this episode was an example of what Janella described as the power of a narrative, which is experientially and cognitively coherent, created in a collaborative discovery conversation with my friend. In my experience of sadness and loss, I was no longer alone. I was looking and moving forward. Though my friend is a skilled therapist, this was not a therapy conversation. It was a conversation between friends. We have a long history, finely honed in the process of writing our book together, of working through issues, valuing the connections and differences in our thinking processes and worldviews. The role she took up was of helping me to figure it out. She listened attentively, was present and responsive. Her responses were affirming and validating. She also brought forward ideas and asked challenging questions. In this context of our friendship, we did not have the risks associated with the power dynamic in a therapeutic conversation where I would be experiencing her as an expert on my life. Where she raised an issue or asked a question which I did not experience as congruent, I found it helpful in clarifying my thinking. Rather than prioritizing what she was saying and trying to fit my thinking to hers, the response which came to mind was, "No, it wasn't like that, it was like this." Intimately as she knows and understands me, skilled and knowledgeable as she is in making sense of human beings, I doubt she could have formulated it on my behalf. As I reflect on the narrative she helped me develop, I can see how someone else may not find it congruent. There are other narratives which would also fit the details of my life and experience. But I had an experience of agency, of sorting out my thoughts, emotions, and experiences. I knew she had helped me a lot, but on an experiential level, I felt I had done it myself. This is the end of Audio 7 on the sixth point of difference, the power of a cognitively and experientially coherent narrative to transform suffering into manageable pain. Feedback and ideas are welcome on info@talkthatheals.org.